The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain. I want to tell you about a service I've been using for over a year now, Aurora. I signed up and they immediately identified over 60 data brokers out there selling my information. The best part is they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. I have a link down below where you get a 14-day free trial. It's risk-free and you can cancel anytime. So it's worth taking a shot and seeing what information is out there. But it's more than just that. They have an app which includes antivirus, VPN, password management, all built into one package. You can use the app or you can use the browser to stay safe out there in the digital space. Again, I have a link down below. You can check it out for 2 weeks free. And if you don't like it, you can cancel anytime.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Want to make a podcast? Let me tell you about Spotify's program for podcasters, and it's called Spotify for Podcasters. I've been using it for over a year now. Couldn't be happier from the switch. You can record wherever you create podcasts, whether it be your phone, computer, and it's easy to upload it and distribute it to everywhere podcasts are heard. With Spotify for Podcasters, you can earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions. Best of all, Spotify for Podcasters is completely free. So launch your podcast today. Get started with Spotify for Podcasters. Go to www.spotify.com/podcasters to get started.
Monarch, Legacy of Monsters, an Apple original series.
The world is on fire. I decided to do something about it.
On November 17th.
This place, it's not ours. Believe me.
The most massive event of the year arrives.
Come with me, you'll know everything, I promise.
Oh my God, go, go, go!
Monarch, Legacy of Monsters. Streaming November 17th, only on Apple TV+.
We ended up taxiing out. We were kind of good to go because we were doing an intersection takeoff and the performance allowed it. We're cracking along down the runway. At about 85 knots, we look into our right 1 o'clock. Three vehicles, no confliction. And I went, yeah, tally. We carry on, and about 95 knots, that's when they turn right. They turn right across the runway. Very clearly, you can see a pickup truck, a bus, and another pickup truck. And I've already determined that I can't stop. And so I'm now trying to work out what speed I can get to. So rotate speed is 125 knots, but 105 knots, it's really clear that if I don't do something now, we are going to hit those vehicles.
Tower, Tamara 6 is released to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Seat tied, Altair 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector, close me, fire projector, delay.
My burn ramp curve was at 354.
Sir, yeah, that's on.
Next, picture, 610, 13,000, RVs in the back.
Driver 1 target.
We have done a pretty good job of establishing that and learning, you know, hey, rank doesn't belong in the debrief. It doesn't belong in the cockpit because everyone's human. Everyone makes mistakes and you got to address that because it's life or death. Like if the captain is making a mistake that's going to kill everyone, you want the young guy to speak up and say, hey, boss, watch out. But sir, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Happy to have you on here. I was glad we were able to connect. This is through a podcast listener that pointed me out to you and your story. So I'm excited to hear. We're going to talk about Afghanistan in one specific sortie, as well as just that time period in general, as well as your Royal Air Force career. So thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Well, thanks, John. It's really good to be here. The Afghanistan evacuation story is one of the most important stories in my career so far. And but for me, you know, as I've gone through a 20-year flying career and I've done stuff in between, it felt like the pinnacle. I was, because everyone always says they're going to be a flying boss. And then so few people manage to do it because of other things. You know, I've had some people who have medical issues, some people where their aircraft's going out of service. And so therefore they can't take flying as the boss because they need to make sure that they guarantee flying for junior guys. But we didn't have that on 99 Squadron, and 99 Squadron was always busy. And, you know, prior to COVID, there were plenty of retention issues. You know, people going off, joining the airlines and things like that. So bottom line, there was plenty of flying for me. And to be honest, I was good as I ever was at flying the aircraft because I managed to get like 800 plus hours as the boss. And the Afghanistan evacuation story came right at the end of my time as the boss. So no, it's good to be here.
Yeah, no, we have lots of digging. Random sidebar here, because you mentioned the retention piece. So not unlike the United States Air Force, we have a slight retention problem. It was really, really ramped up like the mid-2014, all the way up to COVID, right? Then COVID fixed retention because no airlines were hiring. But now it has reared its head again, and retention is yet an issue. I actually saw my buddy point out yesterday, so United Airlines, if you're a military pilot, this is, I don't think, ever happened in the history of airlines, but you can go ahead and apply, even if you have more than 6 months remaining on your active duty tour. They'll basically give you a contingent job offer and say, hey, we'll see you when you're done with your commitment with the military. Like, that's never happened. You always have to be within a couple months of the end of your commitment. They want an availability date, but they're hurting so bad for pilots, all these airlines. So it's creating another retention issue. Is the Royal Air Force, has that come back, or is it stabilized after COVID?
Yeah, so COVID, I mean, I've seen this, you know, ebb and flow over the years. So on my first squadron, which was the L-1011, so it was a TriStar squadron. And back then, people used to come to the TriStar because it was not only a military airplane, it was being used by the civilian airlines as well. And so you could very easily get your air transport pilot's license. I think you had to do one exam, air law, get the hours in, and then you could immediately go and join BA or, you know, Cathay Pacific or any of those big airlines. So there was a relatively small funnel for people to get through, which was coming to the TriStar, but it meant on my first operational squadron, everyone was coming there to leave the Air Force. So from an inspiring perspective, it was like, okay, everyone wants to leave. Love them to stay. I'm the odd one out. So that was interesting. And very quickly, we ended up with a retention problem within the multi-engine fleet. Then there was the financial crisis of 2008, and of course that impacted the airlines, so we then didn't have a retention problem. And then, as you say, as we got towards the end of the 2018, 2019, we then did have a retention problem because the airlines were then back on their feet, and then we had COVID. For the other thing for the Royal Air Force, which you don't have this for the United States Air Force, we procured the Airbus A330, and so loads of people have gone onto the A330. Of course, there's easy read across there to the A320, A330, A350, even the A380. So that has, caused retention problems because ultimately, if you're working really, really hard within the Air Force, and you're going to work less hard for more money in this civilian world, that's going to be a problem. And, you know, and it will continue to be a problem. And, you know, there are lots of ways we can get around that. The military job, as you know, is completely different to the civilian airlines. You know, the Afghan evacuation story is just but one case. You know, I've flown around various different places in Africa, into Iraq, various different places in Afghanistan and around the world, and you just don't do the same job as the civilian airline. But if if it's so hard in the military and you're not enjoying it, then you will look for another way to get that quality of life. During COVID, as the boss, I had loads of people who were lifelong friends who were going, this is not working out for me, or I've lost my job. Is there any chance I can come back to the squadron? And that was a pretty blessed position to be in, where you can help out friends, you know, who literally didn't have any way to pay their mortgage in a couple of months' time. And, because they were on the waiting list for various airlines. So we took about 6 to 7 people back on 99 Squadron, and that was great because you're bringing in experience, you're bringing in people who are really capable, and there was still a job to be done. So that was useful. I think we are now out the end of it, and what you are seeing within the US and the retention issue within the USAF is probably going to be the same for the Air Force. So it's, like I say, it's cyclical, and it follows those big things. And you just need to make sure, you know, the military offer is going to compete with other things.
Yeah, and obviously you can't compete with the money aspect, as you alluded to. The military will never be able to do that. I know for our Air Force, the quality of life piece, that's something that it needs to figure out, in my humble opinion. They've made strides with certain things that have made it better, but then there's a lot of road to cover to fix that. But again, I think you mentioned in your synopsis you sent over to me, and I think it's a great point with you flying the A330 over the Indian Ocean. So you joined the military, right, for a purpose and a mission and to serve your nation, make things better. I think that's what most people probably should do it. But nowhere else will a 24-year-old, a 25-year-old, a 30-year-old have the responsibility of this multi-million-dollar aircraft going into some of these crazy places. Maybe it's dropping off, doing airdrop, it's doing humanitarian aid, it's dropping bombs, whatever it might be. You're just not going to find that. You're not going to get that in the airlines, which I think you alluded to very well in the email you sent over to me.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many different stories. So, you know, one of the stories is, I just remember September 2005. Now, that was a pretty bad year. So it was the 2nd of September 2005, and I had a good friend who was flying on a Nimrod. Now, this was the Nimrod which all of the report is out there now, and it led to the Haddon Cave inquiry. So this was the Nimrod that essentially was air-to-air refueled and then basically blew up over Afghanistan because it caught fire, exploded about 3,000 feet above the ground, and, you know, 14 people died, including a mate that I went through flying training with. Within a couple of days, I was back flying over Afghanistan and refueling F-18s because I was on the tanker, and it was the tanker that refueled the Nimrod. And that was quite a strange place to be. And we were up, we'd done our frag for the evening, so we refueled all of our people, and we sat there. We weren't allowed to be let off station, so we couldn't go home until we were bingo fuel, i.e. minimum fuel, to go back to our base in Muscat. And then there was a mayday, and we are there going, okay, that's interesting, don't hear maydays all the time, and we're just sat there listening away. And it was basically a pair of F-18s. And one of the F-18s had lost half his hydraulics. And he was considering, and it was one of the ones from the carrier, he was considering diverting to Kandahar, but they were fairly sure that if he diverted to Kandahar, then they'd never get that F-18 out of there because they didn't have the maintenance and they didn't have the other aspects. You can't take it apart and you're not going to fly back to the carrier. So they were pretty worried about that. And so what they wanted to do was refuel it and have someone refuel it all the way down the boulevard, the Pakistan corridor. So anyway, KC-135 shouts up and say, "Hey, I've got a bit of gas," and it had about 5,000 pounds spare gas, and it was actually the tanker above us. So we were at 26,000 feet, and it was at 27,000 feet, and they needed to get down. Anyway, lo and behold, we had our hoses out. And these F-18s came up and thought they were formating on the KC-135, but they were formating on us. And the one with the hydraulics problem had plugged into us. And so our amber light had turned into a green light, and he was taking fuel from us. And so we just let them know and let the TAC air traffic know that he's actually plugged into us. And it was like, okay, that's fine. Can you take him down the boulevard? And it was like, yeah, I think we can. And by this point, the KC-135 had 5,000 pounds of fuel. We had 30 tons of fuel. So we had 66,000 pounds of spare fuel. And it was like, yeah, we got loads of gas. We're happy to do this. So we picked up him, picked up his mate. Now, we only have one hose. We've got two hoses, but the L-1011, you can only refuel one hose at a time. So single point refueler. And And so they were kind of yo-yoing backwards and forwards, and we made to go down to the boulevard. And then his mate comes up and goes, is there any chance, just in case he loses any more hydraulics, that we can get the gear down and get the flaps down? And it was like, okay, how slow do you need to go? And it was actually below our minimum refueling speed, but it was, you know, we understood the operational requirement and went, yeah, okay. So we put our slap cell and got our first kind of stage of flap out and cracked on down the boulevard. And this guy was plugging in, and he was you could tell he was nervous on the radio, and it was like, and then he was plugging in, but because he'd put all of his wheels down and all of his flaps down, he now had loads of drag and didn't actually have that much power because he was so slow. And so we now had to toboggan, and so we weren't in the boulevard, and we came down to around about 15,000 feet, and then it was 14,000 feet over Pakistan, and so we were letting Karachi know, and then we kind of took on the Mayday call sign, and it all got really interesting, and then in the end, he got loads of fuel, or we got fuel. We took them all the way back to around about sort of 50 miles away from the carrier. They managed to land safely on the carrier, and this FA team had got back, and that was so rewarding. And we went back and had a couple of beers in Muscat, and you know, we were kind of high-fiving going, this is amazing. Now, you just can't do that in the airlines. And that was one of my stories when I go, you know, I recognize why loads of people are leaving, quality of life, money, and things like that. But but for me, having situations like that, and the low of what had happened on the 2nd of September, where I'd lost a mate, and you know, he died in the most horrific way. And then a couple of days later, you'd had a material impact on someone else's circumstance, and you go, okay, there's something in this. And by then, I'd only been operational for a couple of years, but it kind of solidified my rationale for being in the military.
Yeah, highs and lows, right place, right time. It can go wrong place, wrong time. All that applies. What was a little bit of the back? Can you give me a little bit of background on the Nimrod mishap? Because I'm not too familiar with that. I knew it happened, but that's about the extent.
Yeah, so there's been a full inquiry in the UK on this. So the Nimrod was being refueled, and essentially the Nimrod is an old aircraft, and I think it's I'm not a Nimrod guy, but I think it had about 14 fuel tanks, 7 on one side, 7 on the other. When it gets refueled, as some fuel is transitioning from one fuel tank to another, you might end up with a bit of an overpressure in one of the fuel tanks. And when it overpressures, clearly there's a drain valve, so some of the fuel can come out. So some of this fuel was leaving the kind of the overpressure valve, and it was streamlining down the fuselage, and then it was being sucked into the bomb bay. So the Nimrod used to be able to carry torpedoes and things like that. So it's been sucked into the bomb bay of the Nimrod. Inside the bomb bay, there was a fire detection system, but not a fire suppression system. And inside the Nimrod was also I think it's the environmental control system, which some parts got hot. So you've now got fuel being sucked in, you've got a hot part of, you know, the environmental control system, and it was catching fire. So every once in a while, I think they get an intermittent fuel detection and it was kind of being accepted because they couldn't find any signs of fire or fire damage, and risk was being taken because of the operational imperative. The Nimrod was being used for a very important intelligence surveillance reconnaissance job. So risk was being taken on this fateful day. The aircraft started at 29,000 feet. It was one of my good friends who was, or two of my good friends that we were refueling. They were doing the last a sortie of their TriStar detachment in the morning, and they were going to come back and hand the aircraft over for us, and we were going to do the first sortie of our detachment. That's the way it was going to work. But they didn't come home, and as in the TriStar didn't come home on time, and then an operation to kind of close out all the communications was called, and something was going on. And essentially, the Nimrod had this fire detection system. The fire detection had detected a fire. The fire didn't go out, and so they called a Mayday. There was a Harrier, one of our UK Harriers on side, and went and formated. But the Nimrod started an emergency descent to get into Kandahar. The fire took hold and spread throughout the aircraft, and ultimately the aircraft didn't reach the ground. It wasn't able to get into Kandahar. So it was an awful, awful situation. And so then the investigation looked into the causes of why risk was being taken, and you know, who should hold the risk and being legally accountable and things like that. But, you know, all of those names are on the hall of all the fame of heroes within one of our headquarters. And, you know, those guys were doing a brilliant job, and it's just really, really sad. But that specific incident led to the cancellation of a couple of programs and a whole new look at the way we manage risk within the Royal Air Force. And, but yeah, 14 people died on that day. 2nd of September, 2006 was the year. And,
Jeez. With managing risk, how did it change? Did it elevate the decision matrix, or is it what changed?
What changed? So there's a very clear delineation now between operational risk, things that you need to do kind of in the spur of the moment, and then operating risk. You know, acceptable levels of risk that you can take, and the operating risk you go through a very systematic approach to. Mid-air collision would be a good one, so we call that loss of safe separation. But if you are flying in places where there isn't an air traffic control or it's really, really busy, you know, then loss of safe separation is one of the biggest risks that can cause you know, loss of an aircraft. And so only certain people now at the 06 level, then at the 2-star level, and then ultimately our chief of the air staff, only those people can take risk and hold that risk. And they are then legally accountable for the risks that they take. Whereas previously it was risk was being taken at every single level. And there was a blurring between operational risk. Okay, we really need to do this because this mission is really important. And then some people would say, okay, I'm not sure that we should be taking this risk day after day after day. And then it was being elevated to the next level, say the major level. And then it would be elevated to the 05 level, then the 06 level. And lots of people are taking risk. And then there was the almost the accusation that those people were then not accountable. Once they left the job, they weren't accountable. Whereas now the main thing is those people who take risk are legally accountable for the risks they've taken throughout the rest of their life. So they are personally accountable, which makes you think about things, right? So if I go into a job, you know, as an 06, my next job might be Commander Air Wing, Bryce Morton, and I might be taking some risks on loss of safe separation. Why did, you know, a capability program, or why was that aircraft flying in that position in the sky at a certain time, and then it hits a glider? Or it hits a powered aircraft, and you just go, okay, well, to the best of my knowledge, I was taking risk which was acceptable, you know, as low as reasonably practicable is what we call it, and it's a tolerable risk. But if someone dies, they're going to make sure that you've made the right decisions based on the right evidence and things like that. And, you know, even in 10 years' time, if I've made a decision, it will track back to me rather than, you know, just the next person. So
interesting.
Yeah, personally accountable.
Because, you know, for our military, you know, commanders are moving every 2 years. People are moving every, you know, 1 to 3 years. And so you can inherit, you know, a program that has risk or is a bad deal. I mean, it can go both ways, right? But, like, ultimately, if you're the guy who's holding the baton at that point, like, you might have been day two or day, you know, month two into the job. Like, you're going to be the one who gets crushed. And, you know, the previous commanders, for the most part, like, it's not going to touch them or scare them. Like, they're on to the next job. So that's interesting to be able to kind of go back in time, and I think also force you to think. I can see maybe one fault with that. I'm curious to get your opinion. Do you think that we call it, you know, CYA, cover your ass? Like, are you less risk averse and willing to take a risk, thinking that, hey, you know, it's just easier to play it safe all the time than do it, because inherently the military, you're taking risk. I mean, you're breaking things and doing dangerous things.
Yeah, so I've got two perspectives, and they are definitely Kev perspectives. So post Haddon Cave, we built up a safety empire, appropriately so, because what happened on the Nimrod can never really happen again, because you know, people taking risks, not being accountable for those risks, and then as risk came up, you know, there wasn't the evidence base to be able to, you know, fully understand what the other guy had signed off, and you know, and the operational imperative was the overriding factor that meant the aircraft took off, and even some people who were flying felt uncomfortable. So the, you know, you can't allow that to happen again. However, you know, as you say, we're in the military, and in the military you need to go against adversaries, and you need to be able to, you know, be stand tall and make sure you're counted and have a decisive impact on the battlefield. That is your role in that military domain. And at the moment, and you know, what we did is we built this empire out of safety, rightly so, to make sure things were safety. But because we're always resource limited, anyone who was spare, you know, who was focused on the thinking about how we do military operations, kind of went into the safety kind of you know, domain. And so therefore, you know, we can go and deliver, you know, basic operations, and you know, guess what? Daesh, really exciting to go to the, you know, go and do the counter Daesh campaign, but they weren't a state actor, and you know, in the end, it was pretty straightforward to roll them back, and then in the end, it turned into a counter terrorism thing, which we're all comfortable because of Afghanistan, but people weren't thinking about state on state. People were more than happy to think about safety. Now I'm overemphasizing for effect, but if you need to make sure that you're as safe as possible, then there is the accusation that you've become more risk averse. And I do want people thinking about how we're going to beat potential adversaries. That is also one of the rules of the military. So there's, you know, that was one of the things I observed. You know, people not thinking about how we're going to win against an adversary, but going into the safety domain. So there was that. However, what I would say is, back to the Afghanistan evacuation. When real military operations kind of kick off, you do end up in the right place. So if I go back to the operating risk, we, you know, on the C-17 in the UK, you can only fly 138 people because of the number of seats. Now that is tolerable, and the risk is managed appropriately because you've only got, you know, 138 seats. And so, you know, if people can't sit down, it's not safe. When you come to an evacuation situation, the USAF rules are you can put 350 people on the floor, you know, strap them to the floor, and it'll be fine. That's an emergency situation. But we didn't have those rules within the Royal Air Force because we never really had to use them. And very quickly, almost within hours. So I was actually on leave, and I got asked for a view on, you know, how many people can we take? And I went, guys, I've already fed this information in. We should follow the USAP laws. And the answer is 350 based on this evidence. Once I'd provided the evidence and it was accepted by the two-star, that became operating risk. Okay, there's a valid justification. And so there was the, as you say, the cover your ass element. The Americans are doing this, so this is probably fine. And that became operating risk. Now, when we actually got into theater and we started doing the evacuation, we went above 350. So there was no evidence for that. But I had my pilot saying, look, we've got 350 on board, but because there's so many babies and children, we've got loads of space. And the only thing I cared about, you know, the three risks were, if you had a ground evacuation, can you get everybody out the door? Because that's important, because, you know, if you can't, then there's plenty of scenarios both in the civilian world and also in the military world where if you don't get people out of the aircraft in a ground evacuation, then people might die, smoke inhalation, things like that. So that's, can you get them out the door? The next risk was actually hypoxia. So if you have a loss of pressurization and you're up at 25,000 feet, you've got no oxygen masks because the airplane is not designed for that. So that's a big risk. What are you going to do? And guess what? You're going to get down, but you might not be able to get down because you might be over mountains. So that was a risk to consider. And then the final one was performance. Afghanistan, mountains, you know. And so because we were able to consider those risks in slow time and then pass it up to the two-star level, he was then happy to accept those risks. So that's operating risk. When we got on the ground, it was like, guys, we've got loads of space here and we've got loads of people who need to get out of Afghanistan. Can we go above 350? And that became operational risk. So the operational commander went, okay, I trust you guys, mission command, do what you think is right. It still came down to, can you fit them in safely? And do you have the performance to take off? And if you could do those two things, then you're clear to go. So we, you know, I flew one sortie, which had 433 people on passengers, so 445. And at the time, you know, for about 4 days, that was the record. And then one of my mates, because I'd done that, you know, they were desperate to beat me. Now, I didn't do that because it was like, hey, look at me. I did that to highlight right. that, you know, we need to be operationally focused. And the guys took that and went, okay, that's fine. 350 is not the limit. We can go above 400. And we ended up, I think the UK record now for number of people on an air mobility aircraft is 448. Could we have done more? Yeah, probably. But actually, the limiting factor in Afghanistan at the time was actually the ability to process the passengers. So we'd managed to get into a good rhythm of, you know, getting the right number of passengers in the right time frame. But that's, hopefully that's highlighted a good example between that operating, that considered risk management versus the, we'll do what we need to on the ground.
Monarch, Legacy of Monsters, an Apple original series.
The world is on fire. I decided to do something about it.
On November 17th.
This place, it's not ours. Believe me.
The most massive event of the year arrives.
If you come with me, you'll know everything, I promise.
Oh my God, go, go, go!
Monarch, Legacy of Monsters. Streaming November 17th, only on Apple TV+.
This episode is brought to you by Undeniably Dairy. Dairy farmers are more than farmers. They're climate caretakers. They see water as a precious resource. Most farmers recycle water up to 4 times, from chilling the milk to irrigating the crops. And some even use technology to turn manure into renewable energy. To learn more about what dairy farmers are doing to make their farms more sustainable, visit usdairy.com.
Yeah, that's great. Because that's when you hear that in safety, like, you obviously need to be safe. We've learned a lot of lessons in blood. You don't want to forget those lessons. You want to make smart decisions. But inherently, the military is taking risk. And as you alluded to, you know, I think we all, for the last 20 years, have been operating in uncontested environments and now have forgotten that, you know, we need to be ready to go out there and fight a peer adversary, which undoubtedly there's going to be an acceptable level of risk, which will probably be a defined number of people and planes you're willing to lose based upon each mission. And that's something that we just haven't done in quite a while. And hopefully we don't have to do. I did want to pivot because you mentioned the processing of people. And I think we'll jump into Afghanistan. So we're kind of going backwards here, but I think this is great. All the passengers you're bringing out, you guys were still bringing them out to Al Udeid as well. I've had a couple other podcasts with the C-17 crews talking about just the conditions on the ground and how long it took to process. Were you experiencing the same things as far as where you're moving passengers to? Or were you taking them to a different spot?
Yeah, we were actually taking them to a different spot. So we were going to another airport in UAE. So we were operating out of a base which was about 10 miles to the west of Dubai, and then there was another base in Dubai. So we weren't using Dubai International, but we were operating in two air bases there. One of them was an international terminal that we gained a little bit of capacity from, and we would go there, offload all of our passengers, and then they would get onto one of our Airbus A330 Voyagers and then fly over to the UK. Al Udeid was toppers. It was you know, we've got our exchange pilot, so he's actually just flown home, but he was contributing to some of those missions. And, you know, they were, so their limiting factor was in Al Udeid able to process the passengers. So they ended up with a load of tankers over top of Al Udeid, and then people were tanking them because they weren't landing in Al Udeid, that then flew back to Ramstein. And I understand that because of, you know, I don't want to be coarse here, but because of the amount of feces and urine that had gone through the floor, it destroyed all the wiring, because it turns out that urine is pretty toxic and corrosive,
right?
And so I don't know where they got to, but I was told that, you know, up to 10 of those aircraft were completely screwed.
Well, I saw some of the pictures of some of the US C-17s of the bathroom. Yeah. Which, I mean, I don't even know how you get back to normal after
so,
that.
So our loggies, our J4 community and logisticians did a great job of, you know, the movers on the ground processing the passengers in Kabul. You know, the guys that we were liaising with out of our base that we're operating from. And then, you know, into Dubai World. And then all the way back to Bryce Norton when they, you know, offloaded the passengers. You know, they, you know, it's a bit, it goes all the way back to Napoleon, right? If you don't get the logistics sorted, everything else fails. And right. and they were epic. So we didn't have that many issues like that. They were appropriately, you know, glorified.
Right. Yeah, I know. Fair enough. And I think obviously evident, we see how important logistics, I think the Russian military can talk to that most recently. So logistics, they make it all happen.
Yeah.
I want to pivot because I have talked about that, but I have a little synopsis here. But Wing Commander Kevin Thomas Latchman, RAF, was awarded the Air Force Cross after demonstrating exceptional leadership and gallantry in the face of imminent danger during Operation Pitting, following a suicide bomb explosion at the Kabul airport. You commenced a takeoff. There was a convoy of three vehicles that I'm envisioning were running parallel on a parallel taxiway.
Yep.
And then at some point did a hard 90 left or 90 right, ran perpendicular to your aircraft. But you ended up missing this convoy by 10 feet, which, you know, obviously would have been calamity and killed everyone in the convoy. And most likely you and everyone on the C-17 or just been horrific. I want to talk about this specific mission, but you were awarded the Air Force Cross, and if I understand correctly, Prince William awarded you the Air Force Cross. So I want to talk about that first, because I know once we start talking about the mission, I'm not going to ask anything about Prince William, but that'd be a pretty cool moment, I would imagine.
Yeah, it really was. So I mean, it was just a year ago, so that I went to Buckingham Palace and was awarded that. You know, it's pretty special going to the palace. I'd never been to the palace for any other reason apart from like every other tourist standing outside the gates taking some pictures. What was also quite special, it was a year on from me completing my tour, so I handed over the squadron on the 1st of October, 2021, and this was now kind of 13th of October, 2022, and it was my. I'd done 6 months out in the States at your Air Force Base, and we'd had a great holiday in Disney, and lots of things had happened since then. And then all of a sudden, I was kind of right back in the room and doing interviews about this incident. My daughter's birthday was around that time as well, so I got her. She was there. And normally they only allow you a couple of tickets because it was post-COVID. But one of the stories was, you know, we went to London for my daughter's birthday, and all of us got to go in and see Buckingham Palace. That was cool. My wife and three kids. So all of it was quite a magical situation.
Yeah.
And then Prince William, I was the last person to get my award, and he's gone through the pilot training system. You know, he has been, or, you know, remains a Royal Air Force helicopter pilot. He's done search and rescue, and so he knows the system. And so we chatted for a couple of minutes, and he said, you know, so was it just blind panic? And I went, well, actually, and so I went through the scenario, and he was great, and he pinned my medal on. Slight awkward moment as I come to leave, because I was the last person. What they do, and he's standing there, I assume, for quite a long time, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours beforehand. And as soon as I come to leave, they start playing the national anthem. So I turn around, stand to attention, and then he marches out, and then he gives me a wink, and then he disappears off. And it was cool. It was all really cool. Got some great pictures.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. It's interesting. I guess that was the piece I wanted to ask about too. So he did combat, or he did search and rescue, flying helos. He no longer does that, right? He's now just doing prince duties or royal family duties.
Yeah,
that's how it works.
So he's got lots of roles, as you might expect. You know, you know, he is the Prince of Wales, and he's and you know, you see Princess Catherine also, you know, doing all of their full time roles, and you know, he is now, you know, the next in line for the throne, and you know, there's been lots of activity. Obviously, Her Majesty the Queen passed away, you know, just over a year ago, so that actually happened about a month before I then went to the palace. And so we didn't know whether I was going to go to the palace on time, because they were in grieving for 2 weeks, and it was going to change. It might have changed everything. Was I going to be awarded my gallantry medal by the new king? You know, that was a conversation. Right. But no, it was just a lot's happened. So I'm fairly sure that he is just doing full time, you know, royal family stuff.
We threw a bunch of tea in a harbor a long time ago, and I lost track. But it's interesting to hear about how it all works, and it's cool that I think his military service for stepping into the royal duties there. So, pivoting to the sortie that we're talking about here, can you break down your lead up to Operation Pitting, how you've kind of flowed into this process, and then how you found yourself on the runway that night, and what transpired?
Yeah, so the lead up to it. Before I went on leave, we had an issue, a really unfortunate issue at RAF Bryce Norton, which was the runway was melting, and that's not great. And so we and we were given the tipper that things were not going exactly as per plan in Afghanistan, and with the runway melting, you know, my first issue was they'd said, okay, the A400M can operate and the Herc can operate, but Voyager and C-17 are, you know, pretty much grounded because there wasn't enough space. And I went, whoa. I went, C-17, I only need this much stuff, and let's pull this circle around. And as long as I've got basically 4,500 feet, which I did have, then I can operate this far, or we can bounce out to one of the other airports and still get the task done. Because
How many C-17s does the Royal Air Force have?
So 99 Squadron has 8 C-17s, and we've only got one squadron. And that is our C-17 squadron. Now, we have a training squadron, which is 24 Squadron, who train our pilots now before they come to the frontline squadron. But essentially, 99 Squadron and the Air Force have 8 aircraft. So that was it. That was going on. And so we managed to maintain operations just before I went on leave, and that was kind of just before August. And then for the first 2 weeks of August, I was on leave. And I was in the UK, but all of this was kind of building up. And then we were working out how many people we could get. And we were told it was going to be maybe, you know, 2 days of about 3 flights per day. And that was going to be the ask, just to get, you know, those people who were associated with the UK out. And you go, okay, and have you done the numbers? Okay, yeah, it's, yeah, probably about 1,000 to 1,500.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
People is what our current estimates are. And I went, okay. Now, one of my squadron leaders, flight commanders, was kind of leading all the preparation up to that. But you could see that this was snowballing, and it was building up into something which is bigger than Ben-Hur. And then whilst I was on leave, it was like, okay. And we sent some people forward. Initially, we sent our 16 Air Assault Brigade out to theater. So they are a, you know, combat battalion, airborne combat battalion, and they went in there. And we had an issue where one crew, they got into ground, but they got onto the ground, but the aircraft with the ammunition hadn't managed to get in. So I got a phone call from one of my crews, and it was like, yeah, they want us to take off, but we've had a number of beers now, and they want us to take off. And I was like, okay, let's manage this. And we went back to the authorities and said, we can't take an aircraft off now, but actually we can do this and we can crew rest in this other place and we can get it there and it'll be 3 hours later. Is that fine? It's like, yes, fine. So no reputational damage there due to people having to fly after beers. But the operational imperative, you could see that it was building and that something was really going down. If you end up with a brigade combat team in theater and they are now fully armed, we had our one star extremely high readiness headquarters deployed to Kabul as well, and those guys were tooling up and arming up and they were short of ammunition and they thought it was it was only due to Taliban choice that they didn't overrun the airport. And I think that's important. We were allowed to leave, and then by the time it got to the end of August, it was like, okay, you've had your time. And so that was an important factor, but you didn't know that was going to be the case. Kind of 2-3 weeks beforehand, it was, the Taliban were kind of overrunning the country, and so that is going to cause concern for not only the people on the ground, but the people who, are affiliated to the people on the ground. So that's kind of the build up. In the end, we had to send some aircraft forward. So we sent the aircraft forward. We ended up with initially 2, then 3, then 4 aircraft, and the crews were going forward. And very quickly they started blowing some people out. First a couple of hundred. I discussed before. I'd written a note to the 2-star to get approval for up to 350 people, and so that was kind of approved. So that wasn't a thing. People were jumping on the floor. They were just putting the straps across their laps, and I think the first lift out was about 250. Then it went up to 300, and very quickly up to 350. So it was kind of working. And then we end up with the situation where the Afghan air traffic control kind of fell, and you end up with, another one of your podcasts, I think, where that aircraft took off with 800 people on board, with people falling off, and the aircraft, the airfield got overrun. That obviously paused operations until we were able to, control the airfield. After that, operations resumed. Now, I got there after operations resumed and things were a little bit more stable. Got there on the Monday. My first mission in was on the Wednesday. It was a daylight flight. But when I arrived, I then had pretty much 6 aircraft either there or operating to Kabul or back to the UK, and it was now fully up to speed. There were still some things to iron out in terms of, we had 3 aircraft landing in Kabul, one after the other, with only an hour in between. So there wasn't the ability to process the passengers. So I had some crews frustrated because they were taking off with only vehicles on board and not people. And they're there to evacuate refugees. So some things to iron out. But I took off with 433 on my first trip and went, hey, I'm now part of the club. Happy days. And it's gone relatively straightforward. And so I was going, okay, we'll just do a couple of more trips like this and crack on. One of the limiting factors that we had was night vision goggle qualified crews. So one of the reasons I'd gone out was because I was night vision goggle qualified. You'll appreciate that it's in the middle of summer. So in the middle of summer in the Northern Hemisphere, there's not that much nighttime in the UK. So it's quite difficult to maintain currency. And you'll also appreciate that it was in August, and lots of people are on holiday, on their family holidays. And so ripping people out of their summer family holidays is going to have retention issues. So it kind of links back to the airline stuff. You don't want to completely screw people over. So it was, and also we had one person there who'd already done 8 missions in, this guy, and he got no national recognition. And this is kind of, Not a sore point, but it makes you slightly embarrassed because you end up in a situation which you can't avoid. But this guy did 8 missions, and with his crew did 8 missions and flew about 2,500 people out by, with him and his crew. That's a significant effort.
That's huge.
Those guys were tired and they were not getting very much sleep, so it was appropriate to rotate. So those were the 3 factors: not enough MBG crews, people were on leave, and you've got some people who were really tired. They've been there since the start. So rotating the crews, and so clearly I was good to go. I kind of fulfilled all those criteria. There was already a detachment commander there, so I didn't need to fulfill the leadership role, and I was just there to go and help out. So done the first mission. Second mission, we get the intelligence briefing, and we're told that there's significant that there may be a significant event that goes on and they're trying to mitigate it. But ultimately, as we're flying into Afghanistan and we cross from Pakistan into Afghanistan, we're told to hold, which was rubbish direction because we're not going to hold in the middle of nowhere. But we get told to hold because a bomb's gone off at the Abbey Gate. And it's like, okay. So we go down to long range cruise and continue making our way to Kabul because we're either going to go one way, we're either going to go back or go forward, but we're not going to sit in the middle of nowhere. So we crack on forward and we hold for another sort of, you know, only 15, 20 minutes. And then in the end, we're cleared to make an approach and land in Kabul. When we land in Kabul, it is absolute chaos. It's chaos on the approach in because people are trying to take off very quickly, and they're trying to take off without clearance. It's chaos on the way in, so we kind of have to sort ourselves out as air crew holding. And when we're kind of good to go, and our passengers are ready, so we'll head down. And when we land, turn off the runway, and the ground force are driving Humvees around, and I was doing like say 20, 30 knots taxiing to the pan. And I've got a Humvee driving at 40, 50 miles an hour underneath the wing. And you go, this is not right. And so I just slammed on the brakes and went, right. And I let air traffic know. And I went, if you're in comms with these guys, they need to stop driving underneath the wing. Because one of them must have been so close to the engine, you know, and, you know, anhedral wing on the C-17, the left-hand engine. And you just go, I'm fairly sure he's going to get quite close to that. So we went in and we were told, look, we're not 100% sure who's running around the airfield right now, so keep all the doors closed and turn all your lights off. And again, that's unusual. You don't normally get that in the civvy world. So
non-standard.
So that was it. So the situation then goes, right, we're parked up on the pan. We've got the engines running, so it's all engines running offload engines running on load for the passengers. Because there's no fuel there, and you're burning quite a lot of fuel, so you're burning about 4,000 pounds per hour when you're doing with the engines running on the ground, so you haven't got an endless bucket of fuel.
How much fuel does a C-17 carry? I have not asked anyone that.
Yeah,
yet.
So it can carry 245,000 pounds. We were flying anywhere between sort of 150 to 160,000 pounds probably for a mission like that.
Okay, that's there and back probably with like 30 minutes of holding.
Yeah, there and back with normal divert fuel and engines running fuel and a little bit for mum so that you can keep the engines running and should there be any eventualities on the ground. But Kabul, 6,000 feet high. And you've got 17,000 foot mountains around you. So you are performance limited. So you can't go in there with, say, 200,000 pounds or anything like that. And some of the US tankers, I think, were taken off with shed loads of people, but they had tankers in the overhead. So they were able to. Now, we can't do that from an Air Force perspective. We're at Royal Air Force. We don't have the ability to do air to air if you want. So gotcha. What you've got is what you've got. So fuel.
The one you're with.
We parked up for about half an hour and we're burning this fuel and going, well, we've got a DP here. So decision point on when we go, okay, that's fine. No passengers. We'll head back. But what wasn't an option was turning off the engines and shutting down and then waiting for the passengers to be clear to walk out to the aircraft. So after 30 minutes, we get told, right, we've got 365 passengers for you. Okay, great. That's pretty much a full load. And they're clear to walk across the pan and we start loading them up. That's about a half an hour process. And in that process, all of the lights go out on the airfield, like all of them. And we're speaking to air traffic and the guys from 82nd Airborne are brilliant. They go, hey, we got no idea why the lights have gone out. And he said, it might be that they've blown up the generator, or it might be that the generator's run out of fuel. We don't know, but we're not going to be able to find out anytime soon. I was like, okay, that's a great bit of a predicament. So we've now got the engines running and an aircraft full of fuel and a decision to make. Are we going to go or are we going to stay? And, it really wasn't an option to offload the passengers, go take them back to the compound. I mean, a lot of those guys, they were so distressed. Only a couple of hours before, a bomb has gone off and a number of their loved ones died, we had a couple of people who walked on board the aircraft, and as soon as they crossed the threshold for the aircraft, they passed out, because it was almost like that's it. I've got to the end of my tolerable fatigue, or you know, some people walked on board the aircraft and they were vomiting, and you know, that's how much stress and anxiety that they were in. So offloading these passengers and putting them back into a compound didn't seem like the right answer. At the time, those guys were being sorted out by medics, and we had our force protection board, and they were helping out, and you know, they also did absolute amazing job. You know, whether it be with the kids were going, wow, an amazing aircraft, and were kind of almost oblivious to the scenario. And then when the adults were coming on, this is literally a plane to freedom, and they're running away from an oppressive regime. So so many different emotions, and the loadmasters, the force protection, you know, the medics on board were dealing with that. But other front, I was literally only focused on fuel and being able to take off. So I'm there, and I'm aware of some other regulation which our HERCs operate to, more in the special forces environment. But you know, they're allowed to take off on strips which are unlit, for certain different reasons, and so it's like, I think we need to apply this regulation. Look, Kabul is a massively long runway. It's really wide. It's painted. Do I think that I'm going to have a runway excursion? Am I going to leave the runway? No, I'm on Cox. I can see the painted surface. You know, there's no risk there. It comes back down to that operational risk. It's like, you know, the reason you want MBG lights and, you know, the IR markers and stuff like that is so that you don't leave the runway surface. And so anyway, I had the chat with the other pilot, and he completely agreed. And so we were going to go for this. We ended up taxiing out. There were two aircraft. There was an A400M and a reach call sign to another US C-17 that were waiting at the threshold. And so I went on to the... So we were able to actually take off from the intersection. And we went for it. So rolled onto the runway, 30 to 40 knots. We were kind of good to go, because we were doing an intersection takeoff and the performance allowed it. We were up at full power anyway, because you know, the only option was full power because of the mountains and performance. It's still relatively warm. You know, when I say relatively, it's still August in Kabul, so it's hot, it's high, and even though it's right at night, it was still about 34, 35 degrees. So you know, you're using full power. So we're cracking along down the runway. And about 85 knots, we look into our right 1 o'clock. So I'm flying, the other guy's in the left-hand seat, and he is he's the non-operating pilot, or the pilot non-flying. And he goes, right, three vehicles. They've got their headlights on, and they're driving down the opposite taxiway. And he goes, yeah, right 3 o'clock. Sorry, right 1 o'clock, three vehicles, no confliction. And I went, yeah, tally. We carry on, and about 95 knots, that's when they turn right and come ahead of us. And we probably had about 1,000 feet they were 1,000 feet ahead of us. And immediately I said, we haven't got enough space to stop. And the guy to my left went, yeah, agreed. I went, so I'm gonna keep going. We'll get to takeoff speed. And he went, agreed. So I carry on, and you know, that conversation all happened really quickly, but time kind of slows down. It's like your Matrix moment.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you know, from a pilot's perspective, to, you know, really hammer the point home for those listening haven't been, it's like, all right, it's about 80 knots when you like see them and start talking about it. I mean, you're probably talking about 3 or 4 seconds, and now you're probably at 105 knots. You know, I mean, it's all ticking up. That's what I'm envisioning in my head. At least.
So that's it. You know, we see the vehicles at 85 knots. You know, at 95 knots, they turn right across the runway. Very clearly, you can see a pickup truck, a bus, and another pickup truck. And I've already determined that I can't stop. And so I'm now trying to work out what speed I can get to. So rotate speed is 125 knots. But 105 knots, it's really clear that if I don't do something now, we are going to hit those vehicles. And so, you know, the flight data recorder shows that at 108 knots, I start doing a relatively gentle stick pull. The normal stick pull for a C-17 was somewhere between 15 and 24 pounds of force. When they went through the analysis, They couldn't find my stick pole on there for rotate, and it was an 11-pound stick pole, and so they put all the gains down. So they went, okay, yeah, you were really gentle, but essentially, 110 knots, 110 knots, we lifted off the ground, and once we'd got enough height, I was as gentle as I possibly could be to make sure I had enough height to miss the bus. So we didn't do a normal rotate where you go 3 degrees per second to 15 degrees nose up. No, it was enough height and don't stall and you know, just miss the bus. And that was it. And then we watched the vehicles go below us. And you know what? I was flinching at the time. I was going, are we going to scrape something? And it was pretty uncomfortable. And then it was clear that we'd cleared them. And so I, you know, we were about kind of 5-6 degrees nose up at the time, and then just kind of carried on up to 15 degrees nose up and then carried on with the normal takeoff. The pilot, there was no discussion about like, should I turn right or turn left or do anything like that. But it was just, you know, the only thing that's going to save us here is height. The loadmaster, Di, she was in the left-hand troop door, and I said, Di, how much did we miss those vehicles by? And she went 10 feet, if that. And she was able to clearly see the pickup truck. The first pickup truck went under the number one engine. The bus was under the number two engine, and then underneath the undercarriage, and then the guy who was in the right-hand seat, the right-hand troop door, the other engineer, saw the other pickup truck just go underneath the number four engine. So we were like directly above them. So, you know, there were always questions. There'll always be questions about, so if you would have slammed on the brakes, actually, would you have stopped before they cross? You know, where was it? But the amount of seconds and the decision-making at the time, I think we're talking about whether we hit the first vehicle or the last vehicle. The fact is they couldn't see us because we had no lights on. And we were on GOG, so we could see them, but they couldn't see us. And the only time they would have known about it is when we would have collided with them, pretty much.
Right.
So that was the situation. The funny bit afterwards. So Millie goes says to air traffic, just to let you know, we've had a runway incursion.
It's just a slight one.
Yeah, we've just had a runway incursion, and then the guys. And then I jumped straight on the radio. I went, yeah, just to let you know, guys, a bus has just pulled out in front of us. Now, the TAC air traffic guys were in a tent literally adjacent to where everything happened. And so the guy from 82nd Airborne went, we know, guys, we didn't think you were going to make it. We were praying for you. and I'd love to meet those guys. We didn't manage to get in contact with them, but they saw the whole thing, and so what happened then is on the ground very quickly nothing happened, and as in all operations were stopped until I think those vehicles, the two pickup trucks and the bus, I'm fairly sure I know what they were doing because I've spoken to the person who had tasked them, but they had no comms with the tactical air traffic controller. They also didn't know where they were on the airfield because they hadn't had the airfield familiarization brief. So there were other things that they could put in place. So that was all done. And then operations kind of resumed. I went back. We climbed up, and it was only as we got through 20,000 feet, i.e. out of the threat zone, that all of a sudden we were able to go, yeah, so that just happened, didn't it? It's like, yeah.
Wow.
And everyone was going, okay, yeah, so okay, that was all pretty close. And I went, yeah, and I went into the mission computer, so you know, flight management system, and I was going, how much space did I need to stop? And I was getting the airfield charts out and like drawing. I'm fairly sure I had this much space. And so what I did is I put into the mission computer, how much distance did I need to land? So if I landed at that speed, how much space did I need to stop? And it came out with 1,932. And of course, you can overperform, but it was like, well, I'm fairly sure I only had 1,000 feet, so I was fairly sure that I couldn't stop. But it was instinctive. It was really, you know, you're going, did I make the right decision there? Because have I put everyone's lives in danger? And you're questioning that,
right?
And so I put this all into an air safety report, There was a bit of an embargo on that because we knew this was going to go, you know, everyone was going to go, yeah, Holy Mary, Mother of the...
Right.
And so I reported that up into the operational chain of command and lots of things and let the other guys know what happened, and, you know, and yeah, then it just became a thing and the story took hold and kind of the rest is history.
Level up your listening with Bose Quiet Comfort Ultra Earbuds and Headphones with immersive sound and world-class noise cancellation for a not-so-silent night. Visit Bose.com/Spotify to shop sound that's more than a present.
Introducing Royal Caribbean's newest ship, Icon of the Seas, the ultimate family vacation. The ultimate six slides, eight neighborhoods, zero compromise vacation. The ultimate never done that, can't wait to do it vacation. The ultimate chillin' by a different pool every day of the week vacation. This is the Icon of Vacations. Icon of the Seas, arriving in 2024. Book today. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry Bahamas.
Jeez, that's crazy. Well, I think most of our takeoff and landing that assumption in like the fighter world, it's like they give you 2 seconds to like recognize and then, you know, throttle idle and start applying the brakes, you know? So in that 2 seconds, obviously you're still accelerating. So what was 1,000 feet is now 800 feet or 700 feet, like no chance. But I can just, I'm like envision this like lumbering C-17 probably touching the stick shaker or getting ready to touch the stick shaker. Just floating it out. Not where you want to be in life, but obviously that's where you were. So pretty impressive.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, from flying big airplanes as well, you know, in every scenario that you do in the simulator, you can either stop or reject the aircraft or you can take off. What you don't have to do is go, okay, I can't stop and I can't reach my takeoff speed. What am I going to do? We just don't train for that. And I was asked by Prince William, actually, so are they going to make a new simulator scenario for this? And I went, sir, I hope not. I went, that would be a complete waste of resource. So all of the pilots going through this scenario, what I really wanted to do is protect the airfield and make sure that vehicles don't encroach that surface again, or else it'd just be a complete waste of training. Right. Can you take off? Right. What we want you to do now is take off 50 knots slower, because then that would, you know, be negative training, I think.
Oh yeah, open up a can of worms that you'll never be able to put, you know, you'll never be able to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Not where you want to be in life, I think. But wow, that's spicy. You literally did the standard bus full of nuns on the runway. I don't know if you guys do that with all your emergency procedure sims, but like every, you know, emergency procedure sim you do, like to force a go around or force a abort, it's like you're just coming down final, you're like single engine, and then all of a sudden there's a bus full of nuns on the runway and you got to go around. So you literally did it in real life.
It was yeah. But without the ability to go around, it's like, okay, well, what am I gonna do?
I have no choice. Actually, I recorded an episode 2 days ago which won't see the light of day for quite some time, but it was actually the aircraft commander from the C-17, the first one, where it was kind of overtaken, people hanging on to it and falling off. And he was just describing, yeah, that time, because I was asking about the decision to take off, you know, taxiing down, turning around. You don't know if the airfield's clear, but he's like, you know, couldn't talk to the Apaches, couldn't talk to the MRAPs, all these players on the airfield.
That's
could not talk, you know, and then it's still like, you know, it's going on throughout the entire operation with people driving across the runway. I want to talk to the guys driving that, because can you imagine how loud, like they were probably obviously completely unaware that you guys were rolling down the runway, and their first inclination was probably a C-17 passing 10 feet over them in full throttle, you know, just it'd be wild.
Yeah. Let's just pause it there. My lovely wife has just literally come in. So I just let her know that I'm on the podcast now. Hey, sweetheart. So my son's home from school. So I've had two amazing children here, who've sat perfectly quiet throughout because I exercised them before with the dog. And now my wife's home. And my awesome. Son's up and will be, but just but she knows I'm on the podcast, so that's cool.
No, that's perfect. So, I love it. Yeah, I guess a little later in the day for you than it
is for me. Yeah. So the funny thing. So there's another part to the story. So you then go, right. We've just had this incident. We've done the air safety report. But we have to go the next day, right? So everyone was kind of aware of what had happened, and we'd fully debriefed it, and everyone was comfortable with the decision that I'd made as the aircraft captain, but also as the pilot flying, and the other guy. I don't want to call him co-pilot because he was a qualified captain in his own right. So the other pilot was we were all happy with the decision, but we crew rested, but we had to go the next day because we had lots of airplanes and lots of crews. And so I individually kind of messaged each person, and I spoke to Millie, on reflection, I'm not 100% sure I would have done the same thing as you last night, but I also know that what you did was the right thing. And because he was a captain as well, and I was the boss, I said, look, so first trip in, he was the captain, and I was his co-pilot, and then we were flip-flopping. So the next night in, on the fateful night, I was the captain and he was the co-pilot, and then on this third day it was time for him to be in charge. And he went, look, I'm actually, you know, it's like you've got like loads more hours, and I'm not sure, and I'd just be more comfortable if you were just the aircraft commander tonight. I went, that's fine. I went, but you're still flying it. And he went, okay, I'm happy with that. So he was happy to go flying. I spoke to Di, the loadmaster, and she, I said, are you happy to go flying? She went, yeah, that's absolutely fine. We had another loadmaster on board, and he said to me, okay, how are you going to make sure tonight that I don't die? And actually, that was quite an interesting question. I went, you know what? Anytime we're close to the runway, I'm going to make sure that all of my lights on and I look like a Christmas tree. It's like, I'm not going to take the risk. I don't think we're going to get shot at. I don't think we get shot out of the sky. I don't think that is a valid risk. And that risk is, you know, pales into insignificance compared to, hitting a vehicle on the runway. I went, so we're going to look like a Christmas tree. He went, I'm happy to go flying. And then the ground engineers were happy as well. So we went flying on that third night. But that was an interesting kind of leadership challenge. After an incident like that, how do you still go flying? And so we went for it. And that was cool. And then that was our kind of last mission, really. It was cool. We did our three missions.
That's wild. I mean, quite an impressive story. I would not have wanted to be in that situation. So I'm obviously very glad it worked out the way it did, because I don't know, if you roll the dice on that one, there's probably,
yeah. Now you met
nine times out of 10, maybe it doesn't end.
Yeah,
that
you
way.
Mentioned also about the what was the crew of the bus thinking? When we went back on that third mission, there was a bus that was tipped over on its side. Now we thought that actually there's a bus that's gone directly behind the jetty floats. Have we tipped over that bus? Because and someone else who was there in the daytime before us had got a load of pictures, and basically this bus had gone onto its side and had been bulldozered off the side of the runway. And it was like, did we do that? Because, you know, you think of some of the Die Hard films and things like that, and you just go,
right.
The C-17 at max power behind the jetty flux. It turned out that no, because I'd spoken to the person who was controlling the bus. The bus got to where it went to. It was aware that it had missed the C-17. However, the bus that had tipped over on its side just went around the corner too fast and tipped over. And that's why it got bulldozed off where it was supposed to be. But for about 2 weeks, we were fairly sure that we tipped over a bus, but that wasn't the case.
Yeah, I would think, again, talking about this podcast report the other day, one of the aircraft commanders, his decision matrix for not putting the flaps down, which I never thought about, was he said the C-17, when you put those flaps down, even at idle, now it's just deflecting all that thrust, even at idle, obviously, it's deflecting all that thrust, all that wind, down at the ground. So he was thinking about the people running alongside the plane and didn't want to blast them, because you see the videos on YouTube, I don't know what island it is in the Caribbean, right, where people are hanging onto the fence behind a 747 taking off, just getting sandblasted and blown, you know, 70 feet down into the beach. That, you know, if you pass a bus by 10 feet in full grunt, I would think that one of those vehicles would tip over. That'd be a logical assumption to be making.
Yeah. So So I think it is a logical assumption. They definitely knew we flew over them during the fact, and but in this case, it didn't blow over. Luck, I guess.
Yeah, better lucky than good. That's a joke there, but we kind of went out of order. Before we wrap up here, I do just want to kind of get a snapshot of your career leading up to this, because obviously C-17 time, A-330 time, TriStar time. Can you kind of tell what made you want to pursue a career in the Air Force and want to become a pilot in the first place?
Yes, when I was growing up, I was relatively I absolutely love maths, or math for your audience, and so I was maths and science, and I was going to be one of three things: an accountant, a Jedi, or a pilot. And a pilot, because I'm Top Gun era, and so absolutely loved the film that came out last year or the year before. So I'm that era. I realized relatively soon, because I'm not too stupid, that I couldn't be a Jedi, because I've got too much of the dark side in me, and and then accountant. It was my mum who wanted me to be an accountant, because she was historically bad at money, and so it was like to sort her life out. And she went, accountants get paid lots of money. So from a really early age, from kind of 8, 9, 10, I wanted to be a pilot. You're always a construct of your childhood self, aren't you? So we only had three videos back then. It's not like streaming of nowadays. I think we had, we had Grease, we had Dirty Dancing, we had Top Gun, and I think we had Police Academy. And I'm definitely a product of all of those things. So anyway, wanted to be a pilot from an early age. I come from a very working class background. Went to the worst school in. Well, I thought what was the worst school in my local area? It turned out, actually, for the year that I passed my exams at 16, that it was the worst school in England. For various different reasons that I don't need to elaborate now. But, by the time I got to 18, I wanted to be a pilot. I'd applied for university, so, the equivalent of your college. But I just wanted to go and get a job. And the Air Force offered me, pilot in the Air Force. At 18, and I joined at 18, so that was it. Because you guys can't join at 18 and go straight in. So I went into training. That was in 1999, and absolutely loved it. And I went initially through the fast jet stream. That didn't work out for a number of reasons. I loved flying the Tucano, kind of like the PC-9 equivalent, and then I loved flying the Hawk T-22-ish. But I didn't get to the end of the fast jet stream, and they said, "Oh, well, it hasn't worked out for you. Do you want to go and fly helicopters, or do you want to go fly multi engines?" And going back to helicopters, you've spent a number of years in the flying training system already, and if you go helicopters, you have to go all the way back to the start. So I elected for multi engine. So I think I got chopped from fast jet training in the February of 2003. By the time it got to September 2003, I'd gone through multi-engines and I'd been selected to go to the TriStar. And that was cool, because the TriStar did air-to-air refueling as well as air transport. And I was told air-to-air refueling was the sport of kings and queens. And so I went there, and actually I really enjoyed the air-to-air refueling side. And it was, like I say, everyone was trying to leave and join the airlines at the time. So from a squadron ethos perspective, that it was maybe not the best, but the aircraft was great and the people were great and the operational task was great. I got the opportunity to go to the C-17, and after that, all of the things clicked for me as a military pilot and someone who wants to do something valuable for the country, because the squadron, the ethos and the morale on 99 Squadron was just like unbelievable, and the aeroplane was great, and the people were great, and the tasking was great. So all of those things combined to create this magical combination, which for me absolutely solidified my reason to be in the Air Force. And because I loved it there and did all right, you very quickly, success breeds success. So you get promoted. And because I've been promoted, they then offered me the opportunity to be one of the first pilots on our brand new tanker. So I had glass cockpit from C-17, and I had air-to-air refueling experience, both towline and trail on the TriStar. And so it was, you know, those things had combined. I'd already changed aircraft type once, so then you're not really scared of that. So they said, do you want to be a flight commander on C-17 or bring in a new aircraft? And I went to that new aircraft, and that was epic. And I got my air transport pilot's license and flew A330. And that was a great journey. But after that, though, TriStar, C-17 and Voyager, three of the biggest aircraft that the Air Force has ever had. And I've been doing ops for 10 years, but it's kind of tactical. I needed to get away from big aeroplanes, RAF Bryce Norton, and ideally the Air Force. So I went into our joint environment, working with the Army and the Navy and the Marines. And you very quickly realize the things that combine you are much stronger than the things that separate you. And I really enjoyed that. And I got a look at how our special forces operate, and that was cool. And very quickly, because I enjoyed that job, you continue to thrive, and you get promoted again, did staff college, went and did a really good staff job again, supporting our, non-conventional forces. And that was great. And during that, I then got selected to be officer commanding 99 Squadron. So unit command of the squadron that I absolutely loved, you know. So I've had a pretty, you know, blessed time going through, and OC-99 was just, you know, the best job. The people, the squadron, the tasking, you know, and the Afghan evacuation came up right at the end. Since then, I've still had a great time. So I finished that, went out to Shaw Air Force Base for 6 months, and Shaw was great. South Carolina. Great people working with the USAF, but working within a coalition as well. And that was six of the best months that I've ever had in the military. And then I've come back.
Well, you know, you might be the first person I've heard describe Sumter, South Carolina as that. I mean, I spent about 6 years in Sumter. It's a great spot. It's a quaint little town. So I'm going back there.
It is great. You need to go to South Carolina karting and have a look at the leaderboard there. Yeah. We did a lot of karting, and I think me and my buddy are still third and fourth on the leaderboard.
Duly noted. Did you ever go to the dirt track? So this was Carney, as I mentioned, was our British exchange officer. He was all about this. So there's a dirt track with like little stock cars out there racing. I mean, it's in the middle of like nowhere, you know, but on Friday night, that's racing season. You back your pickup truck to the back of the, you know, to the racetrack, and it's full on.
We didn't do
experience.
That. We went to some baseball games, the local baseball college team. We also went to a few NBA games, went up to Charlotte and saw those. And, you know, we definitely took in the culture. We learned to play football, and we taught everybody cricket. And so there was a sharing of cultures. So, no, we had an amazing time. And then straight after that, I bounced back. And then went straight down to Tampa, and then took the kids to Disney and had an amazing time in Florida. So, you know, that was a crescendo to a brilliant kind of op tour for what you want to call an op tour. And then, of course, during my deployment, I found out that I was being awarded the Air Force Cross, and then I found out that I was being promoted, and it carried on, and now I'm in the job I'm in right now. And again, it's multinational, it's joint, it's interesting, it's NATO focused. You know, clearly there is a war in Europe, and so it's relevant. So I'm having a great time. That's my career.
No, Kev, I really appreciate you joining me. I hope you're willing to stay around for just a quick There I Was story and share it for my Patreon supporters. Before we wrap up, any parting shots? If you found 15, 16-year-old Kev walking down the street, is there any advice you would give him?
15, no regrets. I don't have any regrets now. Clearly, when you get chopped from fast jet training, or you end up in some of those low points, you know, you can't really change those. So kind of, you know, I've mentioned a number of times, you know, I know I've got the big man looking after me, and because of that, it also means that you know it doesn't allow pride to seep in. So just back yourself, don't get too big-headed, And make sure that you look after the team around you, because if you know, it's all about the people. It is all about the people.
Absolutely. Kev, thanks for joining me on the podcast. I really enjoyed talking with you today, and thanks for sharing your story.
Thanks a lot.
The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit GunsGarin.com/rain.
I want to tell you about a service I've been using for over a year now, Aurora. I signed up and they immediately identified over 60 data brokers out there selling my information. The best part is they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. I have a link down below where you get a 14-day free trial. It's risk-free and you can cancel anytime. So it's worth taking a shot and seeing what information is out there. But it's more than just that. They have an app which includes antivirus, VPN, password management, all built into one package. You can use the app or you can use the browser to stay safe out there in the digital space. Again, I have a link down below. You can check it out for 2 weeks free. And if you don't like it, you can cancel anytime.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.